Welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Gals Podcast. Sharon Vornholt is your host and the creator of the Louisville Gals Real Estate Blog, where you will learn how to become a savvy real estate investor, make money, build streams of passive income, and create a lifestyle and a business you love. Whether you're a seasoned real estate investor or just getting started, this show is for you. Now, let's talk real estate investing.
Right. Well, let's talk about how you decided to move into the virtual end of it to invest in other parts of the country. Now, let's talk about that process and help folks to understand how that works.
Yeah. And again, like I said, I'd love to tell you that I'm a genius and I had this grand master plan. But in 2007, as I was going through just that maelstrom of horror and losing everything, we got the book called The 4-Hour Workweek by Timothy Ferris, which if you've never read it, I highly recommend. And it was a complete paradigm shifter for me, complete game changer mentally, because prior to that, I was, you know, Mr. Brick and mortar. You know, I had one of our office locations was $27,000 a month just for the rent. That didn't include the employees or payroll or insurance or work comp or, you know, the lights and internet, just nothing else. That was just one of the rent payments. And I'm like, you know, I really don't want to go back into that again. Okay. You know, the whole class A office space thing, you know, I had a whole closet full of, you know, $1,100, custom tailored suits, and I've done the dog and pony show and all that. And I just really did not want to get back into that arena again. And basically, the virtual thing happened by default and not really by design, out of sheer necessity, because when we did that one deal and left Atlanta, I ended up in Orlando, but our entire book of business still happened to be in Atlanta. That's where all the properties were. That's where all the buyers were calling from. And, you know, one of the deals that we ended up doing while we were there in Orlando was for a former NFL football player on a $1.2 million new construction property where there was a builder who was trying to sell, couldn't because nobody could get a mortgage. And, you know, we ended up doing that. And he ended up doing a testimonial for us afterwards. And he said, it was really kind of funny. He said, yeah, when I had to send the initial $15,000 wire to buy in the contract, and he had to do that because the house was not complete. The builder hadn't finished. He was waiting for the buyer to choose the stain on the floors and the chair rail and wainscoting and the library and all that. And so we bound the contract and then required the remainder, you know, upon occupancy or whatever. But anyway, so he said, yeah, he said, I remember, you know, when I had to send that initial $15,000 wire, you know, the knots in my stomach waiting for Ashton Kutcher to jump out and tell me I'd been punked. And I don't know if you remember that show, but just, it's kind of like the candid camera of the 2000s, I guess. It was on MTV and all that. But anyway, so he said, yeah, I remember that. He said, then I went to the house and there was an army of workers out there finishing up the floors and doing the stain work and all that. And everything was exactly the way that it was supposed to be. And I was just a voice on the phone. We'd never met, you know, and here we are. At that time, that was the biggest wire we had received to date, the biggest individual wire we'd received to date. And that really kind of spoke volumes that, okay, we can do this virtually. And we've just been doing it ever since. I mean, so it was really out of necessity because I wasn't going to drive back to Atlanta to close the deal. And there was no reason to. What do I have to do with the house? The builder's there. You can talk to the builder until you're blue in the face. He has all the answers. It was listed with a Keller Williams real estate broker. So it was more out of, I don't want to say accidental intent than by any type of design, so to speak. And it's like one of those things, once you realize that it works and that you can do it, all of a sudden, all of those, I can't leave your head. And it's never I can, it's how can I. So that's how we think of everything now. It's not I can't, it's how can I. And that's what we teach our, you know, teach our kids as well, so they don't have that negative thinking. And that's a big thing that, you know, your listeners should really look at applying into their own business models as well. Backing up to the Tim Ferriss thing, if you've never read the book, it's based on lifestyle design. It's based off of locational independence and basically building your business model to work for you so that you can work from anywhere and never have any issues. And so that became really for me sort of the paradigm shifter of, okay, that's really how I want things to be. I want to be able to go and do whatever I want to do at any location that I want to go to and still be able to do business and make money. And, you know, we proved that in Orlando, and then we left Orlando. We went to the beach in Santa Rosa. And I mean, the kids since that time, and we've been everywhere. We've been, you know, took them out to Legoland out in California. We spent a number of experiences in and around Phoenix and Scottsdale, in Anthem. We've taken them up to Colorado a couple times to the mountains to, you know, see the snow and go hiking and all. I mean, just they've had an experience that was unlike anything I had ever personally experienced as a child, because I was stuck in Ocala, Florida until I was 17. So my kids had seen more states and done more things by the time they were five than I'd done, you know, by the time I joined the military. I didn't see snow for the first time until I was in basic training, if you can believe it.
Oh, my word. let me ask you this, Vincent. That's hilarious, by the way. It's pretty easy to understand now if you're dealing with new construction, but let's say you are trying to put a deal together and the house is 35 or 40 years old. What's your process for somebody's got to make sure there's a house standing in this different state? You know, who looks at the property? Do you work with realtors? And how do you handle contracts when working in multiple states to be sure you're in compliance with whatever state requirements there are?
Well, you hit me with a lot of questions all at once, so let's back up for a second.
Yeah.
So if the house is 35 to 40 years old, and that doesn't happen that often, but you know, it's like what they tell you when you go through your real estate licensing. Initially, it's the caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. I don't have a need to go see the houses myself, because basically the way the purchase contracts work, you know, we're taking on the property as is based off of the seller's disclosures. Okay. So
okay.
When the buyer goes out, okay, the buyer, the end buyer or the borrower, which is what they become, when they go out to see the property, they're really the ones that are going to be determining whether or not there's any problems with the condition of the house. And if there are, and there have been at times where something had to be done or needed to be taken care of, then that gets noted and it gets taken care of either prior to occupancy or depending on what it is. If they have to move quickly, then we have it as a clause in the contract that it'll be taken care of within X number of days or weeks after they take possession of the house. Oddly, in these scenarios, in the last 7 years, we've only ever had one person pay for and do an inspection, and that was on that $580,000 house that's in a gated community and on a golf course. And the reason that happened was because there was a known water leak in the front yard, and everybody wanted to make sure that there was no issue with let me back up. They wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to flood the fully finished basement that had a big oak bar in it and media room and all this kind of stuff. And so they paid the money, and you know, it was about a $3,000 repair that had to be done to fix the leaking pipes. And that's happened. But on every other deal we've done, people, you know, and they have every right to, and it's all disclosed up front, but they don't pay for inspections. And I can tell you, in 7 years, I think the only other phone call we've ever gotten about any type of issues, there's been two. And one of them, it was that second deal I did with the foreclosure rehab people. She's upstairs taking a shower and he's downstairs on the computer, and all of a sudden he feels water on his head and there was a leak. And so we called up the seller, even though he was not at this point in time, you know, financially responsible. All that had been basically waived at that point. They had taken the property as is. But we called up the seller and said, yeah, you know, I did a repair on that, and thought it was fixed, but apparently it was not. So just tell them to get it fixed and then deduct it from the next month's payment. And that's my responsibility. And that's what happened. And then one other time, it was actually on one of the new construction properties that the bank had. We had, they had a problem with one of the air conditioner units. And, you know, it's 85 degrees outside. The people are dying on the inside, and the thing's collecting water. And so we had the AC guy, but it was all under warranty, so it was all taken care of. I advise everybody up front in the contracts to get a home warranty. I mean, they're only about $350 to avoid any type of issue that would, you know, pardon me. Yeah, any type of issue. Because what you don't want to have happen is this, is somebody comes in, they pay money down, you know, they're paying five figures down or more, and they get in the house and 2 weeks later, you know, the AC or furnace or something goes out and it's $5,000 to fix it. And maybe they don't have that amount liquid anymore to do all that. That's not a good scenario, because even though they would have accepted responsibility for it, now everybody wants to pull their pistols out and say, well, no, you know, it's your responsibility. No, it's your responsibility despite what the contract says. So we push people in the direction of getting a home warranty up front so that if anything like that ever does happen, that it's not financially devastating and it doesn't cause the deal to implode because you have somebody in a property that now is not habitable for whatever reason. And, you know, thankfully I'm knock on wood as I say this, but again, that's never been the case. Any type of time we've ever had any type of issue, it's been something that's been easily resolved.
Well, that's just mind boggling though, to me, that they don't get inspections. Even when you're buying a property to live in and you're buying it as is, I don't understand why they would spend a couple hundred bucks to find out the true condition of the house.
You know, I can tell you in large part what it is. You know, I mean, think about this. It's when you look at things, if you step outside for a second, you say, okay, all these people are in all these houses. I get phone calls every single week from somebody who's in a property, not on a deal that we've done. There's a prospective buyer that's calling us and saying, hey, yeah, I got the knock on the door that even though I've been making my payments here for 2 years, the guy's been pocketing the payments and the house has been foreclosed on and now I'm being evicted by the bank. And in that scenario, you know, renters, tenants never think to validate monthly that the mortgage is current. Okay. Because it's just a different sort of mentality that's, they're not in control. They're subordinate to the landlord. And so they don't do what would be a very basic thing to me is, you know, ensuring that you're not going to have some issue while you're at the house. And so the reason why people don't get inspection, they've been to the house, they've turned on all the faucets, they've got the electric on, they've been able to test everything. And I think in, you know, many cases, it's like a rental. You don't get an inspection when you go rent something, even though these aren't rentals and even though they are putting significant money down. I think it's deemed as an unnecessary expense if they've had an opportunity to sort of test drive it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe that's it. If you're just a flat out homeowner and you are getting a mortgage and maybe that's it. Maybe that's a different mindset than a rent to own or a lease option or, you know, whatever owner finance, whatever you want to call that exact scenario is. Maybe that's just it. Right there, it's the mindset.
I think it must be, because you have to understand, even on a conventional purchase, really, in most cases, the purpose of the inspection is normally negotiation, so you can get price down, typically. You know, it's the second negotiation after an agreed-upon price is generally how that works in the conventional retail market. But I think, you know, in these cases, people are just like, it's just an added unnecessary expense. What are they going to tell us? I mean, we've never, you know, again, knock on wood, we've never had anybody's house burned down because of faulty wiring. We've never had anybody get flooded because of faulty pipes. I mean, and I don't know if we're just fortunate or what, but I mean, it's never been a scenario that's ever really come up other than a couple of incidents, like I told you about, that were really not all, you know, they weren't all that drastic. I mean, one was a $450 repair, so that wasn't a big deal. You know, not deal breaker type things.
You find the property, mm-hmm. and then you find the buyer, and then they move in. Then it's who's taking care of the repairs? Is this a true rent lease option? How do you structure this part of the deal?
Yeah, no, these are actually done as bona fide sales through a contract for deed, land contract, installment sales contract, bond for title, grant deed. It depends on what state you're in. They call them different things. But it's a legitimate bona fide sale as far as the IRS is concerned. And so the buyer, in order to receive the tax deduction, must take over everything associated with the property in the same sense that they would if they bought the house and had a mortgage from Bank of America. So the buyer is responsible for all maintenance and repairs. Okay, but unlike a lease option, where, and we actually did a one of our hot seat webinars on this, under a lease option, even though everybody does it this way, it's not legal under any state law that I'm aware of to convey or require in a contract that a tenant in a lease option deal be responsible for maintenance and repairs, because that is a landlord's responsibility. And everybody does it that way, but it's not. If you take a look at, you know, I know in Georgia, the what's called the OCGA or Official Code of Georgia Annotated for Landlord-Tenant Law, it's not legal. You can't do it. And because basically what you've just created is what's called a de facto or a disguised sale. You're taking somebody and you're trying to give them all the responsibilities of a homeowner without all the associated benefits like the tax deduction and appreciation potentially and you know, the ability to not have a landlord, that type of thing. So these are actual bona fide sales. We want people that want to own a home, own a home, not be tenants. I don't like career renters, you know, just because they tend to be, not always, but, you know, they tend to be more expensive, if you know what I mean, both in time and money and more hassle. So we're looking for people that actually want to purchase a property. And so they purchase it. They're coming in. They put their money down just like they do on a conventional purchase. They're paying a mortgage payment just like they are in a conventional purchase. They get a tax deduction just like they do on a conventional purchase. They don't have a landlord. If they want to paint, they paint. If they want to get a dog, they get a dog. There's nobody there looking over them. Basically, as long as the monthly payment is made on time, they're never going to hear from anybody, just like you don't hear from Bank of America as long as you're paying on time.
One thing I think people get hung up on is the values. If you obviously can't have MLS access in every state. So how do let's say I'm on Craigslist and I want to sell my house for $250,000. If you're talking to me, how do you determine if I'm in a different state that my house is actually worth $250,000?
That is a fantastic question. And the answer is I don't. And let me explain to you why
you
that.
Don't.
Well, no, I don't. And I'll explain to you why that is. First, I'm not a licensed appraiser. And even if I were on these deals, and this is you're going to get into something here. I'll explain this to you from a real estate and from a sales standpoint. But people, and as I say this, there's going to be a whole backlash. I can hear it already. Retail buyers do not buy properties based off price, ever. They don't. They buy them off of payment, terms, or a combination of the two.
Payment.
Yeah, it's never based off price, okay? So, you know, if when you go out and you buy a home to live in, and I know a lot of investors are saying, well, what are you talking about? You have to, you know, you're trying to get a discount. You're trying to get the best price you can get. That's investor thinking. And what investors do when they say this kind of stuff is they're selling to their own ideals. Okay. That's not how retail buyers think. And so when we're putting these transactions together, I don't negotiate the price at all because it's irrelevant. And the reason that it's irrelevant is because there's actually a number of factors. And I have to explain this sometimes to both buyers and sellers who actually ask this question. First, from a seller's perspective, if I were to go into a seller and say, you know, that we want to get the property at a discount, basically, here's what the seller is going to hear, okay? This is not what I'm going to say, but this is really what he's going to hear. He's going to hear, Mr. Seller, what we want to do is we want to contract on the house, and we're going to make the payments on the property. And the person that's going to be making the payments, you know, they may or may not have a proven track record of paying payments on time. They may have just been foreclosed on. They may have, bad credit all the way around. They may or may not pay you on time. They may or may not take baseball bats to the walls and leave in the middle of the night. and all of the things that sellers and landlords are concerned about. And oh, by the way, mm-hmm. we'd like to get the property at a discount because we heard it's a buyer's market. That's what a seller is going to hear.
Right.
So that's a deal killer, as far as I'm concerned, for this type of a transaction. And when we've had buyers in the past that have wanted us to negotiate the price down, I'm like, we can do that, and we can attempt to do that. But I'm telling you, it's a non-starter from the very beginning, because if I'm the investor in that deal, I say investor, the seller, the original deed holder, mm-hmm. from my perspective as a fellow investor, if he's going to have the mitigated risk of somebody on the property that, you know, may do all those things, then he also needs to have the upside potential that goes along with that investment. Okay. So he deserves to get full price for that house, and he deserves to get, you know, full coverage of everything during that period of time, because ultimately he's the one with all the risk. So what I have to explain to buyers on these things is that, look, here's the beauty of these deals is, as long as you go in with your eyes open, you can't get hurt. Okay. But the caveat there is you have to understand the metrics on these things and how they actually, the mechanics on these and how they actually operate. So if we go down the path of you get into the property and say we agree to pay $250 today, and everybody agrees that it's not worth $250 today, well, let's look at what happens. Number one, you're not really paying $250 today. What you're paying today is, you know, $1,500 for the payment on $250. And the only time that price becomes important is when two converging forces collide. And those two converging forces are the appraised value at the time the buyer is qualified for financing. That's when the price becomes important. Okay, so let's take this down that path. At that time, the lender is going to do an appraisal on the property. If the property does not appraise for the $250, well, you've just been protected, because the good news is you can't pay too much because the bank's not going to finance it, right? So you can't overpay for the house. You can't overpay for the house because no bank will finance it. So at that point, what's going to happen? Well, let's take a look at it from the seller's perspective for a second. If I'm a seller and I want out of a property, I wanted to sell the property initially and couldn't because nobody could get financing. Now I have a buyer in the home that's been paying me on time every single month for 12, 18, 24 months. Who has done what they're supposed to do. They're qualified for financing. They want to close, but they cannot close because the home does not appraise. As an investor, my options at that point are the following. When I say investor, if I'm the seller, I can, if I have the equity position, I can drop the price down to a point that the buyer can qualify. I say equity, it's not technically equity. If I have the spread between, you know, the value and what I owe on it, his equity technically, you know, I can drop the price down and allow the buyer to close and get either out from underneath the mortgage or get out from under the mortgage and take my profit and move on to the next deal. Or I can do that with a combination of any equity I have in cash. Or we can extend out that contract and let him continue making the payments on the property as he has done faithfully for the last 18 to 24 months. To hopefully allow the property to recapture, you know, the lost equity or negative AM or whatever you want to call it at that point, so that eventually he can close at the 250 if that's my number. And if I have a mortgage at $250,000, then I have to do that because I don't have cash and I can't reduce the price down. And so essentially what I have to try to explain to people is that, just like on a conventional purchase where you really have two different negotiations, like we talked about earlier. So if you and I were to go into a deal to buy a property retail, we negotiate the price at $250, and then the inspector goes out, and then even though we already have a price defined, the second negotiation begins. And that's standard practice on every residential retail sale. So just like that, where you have two separate negotiations predicated on price, this isn't really any different. It's just they're at two different times. They're not, you know, within weeks of each other. And so I'll give you an example of a real deal. We actually had this happen. I got a guy we got into a house in 10 Mile, Tennessee, directly on the lake, and it was about a $460,000 house. That's the contract price. And in the property, paying faithfully for 2 years, and we go to get, you know, get him financed and all that. And when the comps come back through no fault of his, not that there have been, his issue is that because of the property was on a, it's on a lake, and it's, you don't have as many sales obviously on a lake in this type of environment because it's not near a big city. There weren't any sales at all to support that value. And so I went through and I shot a video for the seller and I said, hey, look, here's the deal. And here's the comps that your realtor provided from the MLS. And basically what's going to happen is the valuation is going to be determined to be this. If the appraiser goes out, you know, which they wanted about $1,000 to go out and do the appraisal because they knew there were no comps. And I said, you know, we're going to go back to square one. He's not going to be able to get financing, period. So with just with nothing other than that, you know, the seller was willing to drop his price and extend out the contract because he didn't want the house back. And it's not the buyer's fault that the home doesn't appraise. It's not that the value isn't there. I mean, obviously there's a cost to construct based on the square footage that there's value, but the value from a comparative comparable sales approach could not be substantiated or justified because there simply weren't any sales. It wasn't that there were sales at a lower amount. There just weren't sales within the prior 6 or 12 months that were remotely closer supported that type of value for that house. So even though, you know, I'm out of the deal, okay, because I was out of the deal 2.5 years ago at that point, we still get back involved because, you know, you're still married to the people. I mean, they're your clients. And if you're smart, you know, you understand that they're going to be referral generators for you for years to come. And so I got back in, I explained the situation for everything. I renegotiated the entire transaction. The seller dropped off, I think it was like $40,000 or so right off the gate after he saw the video that I shot for him, which was not designed to do anything other than illustrate the truth. Here's the facts as we have them today. Now here's all the different things that we can do to hold this thing together. And, you know, ultimately he agreed to extend out the contract and the buyer didn't lose the house, and everybody went on down the road.
Incredible. Okay. So really, your model is you're putting together someone that has a house they can't sell, that they really need to sell, and you've got usually got a buyer that for whatever reason can't buy through traditional means. So your seller, it's a win-win for everybody. Your buyer gets in a house, the seller gets rid of the property, and you just marry those two people in the transaction.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, okay. Elementally, if you want to look at it that way, our model has changed a little bit.
Yeah, at the simple.
Yeah, Dodd-Frank.
Really.
Yeah. Because Dodd-Frank changed a little bit of that, but yeah, as simply as we can make it, say yes, there's a house with somebody who wants to sell and can't, a buyer that wants to purchase but can't qualify, and you're solving both of their problems. That's how you make money, is by solving people's problems.
Exactly. I tell people all the time, we're not in the house business, we're in the problem-solving business. So given that that's really not that simple, but that's kind of the gist of what you're doing. You're the person putting all these people together. How do you get paid out of the deal? How do you structure it so that you get paid?
The couple different ways. It depends. Every deal is different. But if you take a look at the standard vanilla deal, it's not all that dissimilar from like a lease option. There's a price that we contract on the property for. We mark that up. We sell it to the buyer for our cost plus profit. And then the buyer makes a down payment in cash. And that is where generally on the average vanilla deal where the funds come from today for us to be paid, but because of the way the contract is structured, the buyer is getting credit for his down payment. So it comes directly off of his purchase price. You know, assuming the house appraises, then it's credited against the principal balance towards his equity position when he goes to refinance, because again, these are bona fide sales today. Okay. It's not a lease option. So when they go to get a mortgage, say 12 months from now, they are getting a rate and term refinance. They are not getting a purchase money mortgage because you cannot purchase what you already legally own, even though they don't have the deed yet. They still have chain of title. So in that, you know, under that circumstance, it's not like and let me qualify this. I've done a ton of lease options. I've done them on homes I personally lived in before. They have their place as long as everybody understands the mechanics of how they operate. But unlike a lease option where you pay an assignment or you're paying a fee, right? That isn't right. credited, isn't right. really credited towards anything. And lenders in most cases are not going to give you a rent credit for it. So it becomes money that just disappears. We didn't want that to be the case. If somebody paid money down, I wanted them to have full credit for it in their transaction as a legitimate down payment. And I wanted them to have all of the benefits of home ownership, including the tax deduction and first time home buyer tax credits and all that. So that's the way that they're put together. It was really designed, and this is something that I don't know that anybody else has ever done, because the typical vulture investor model, when it comes to buyers that don't qualify for conventional financing, is to slam dunk them in a lease option, get the option fee. Whether or not they can qualify during the contract term is immaterial. In fact, you hope they don't qualify most of the time so that you can hit them again for another option fee 12 months from now or 24 months from now or whatever, mm-hmm. or get them out and get somebody else in that'll pay another one. And that's the typical model, the way it's done. There was really no concern for, in many cases, for people structuring deals to win and succeed. And I did not want to be in that business. I wanted solid deals designed from the very beginning to succeed, designed to help the buyers get qualified for conventional financing, to refinance the property into their name, seller gets out, gets any equity he has, et cetera. And it's just, you know, a true win-win. And what nobody did back in 2007, and I'm not even sure they're doing it today, is nobody treated buyers that didn't qualify or that had quote-unquote bad credit with Ritz-Carlton service. And the way I always looked at it was this. This is the buyer is the one that's paying me today. Okay? Now, if he has a 300 credit score or a 900 credit score, neither one of those things impacts the fact that he's paying me over $10,000 today. So if he's paying me that money to, if he's paying me that money today, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, whatever it is, if he's paying me that money, why doesn't he deserve a great level of service and respect? I never understood that. And what people want to do is they want to take these people that, you know, they don't qualify, or they've got, you know, the quote unquote bad credit, so to speak, and they want to utilize that as a psychological leverage or advantage against them to charge them more, treat them worse, and expect more from them than they would somebody that had an 800 credit score. And so here's the
thing. You nailed that one. That is the way it is a lot of times.
Yeah, it is. And here's the thing, though. Whether somebody has a 300 credit score, or let me say it a different way. If somebody has an 800 credit score as an investor, that is not an insurance policy that pays out that I get a payment every single month. It doesn't mean anything. That's past history. Okay? It doesn't guarantee me a payment every single month. So if it doesn't guarantee me a payment every single month, why do I care about it?
Exactly.
You know, and if that's not going to be the case, yeah, I mean, if that's not going to be the case, I mean, why, I don't, you know, I've been on all sides of the credit spectrum personally. I mean, I've had terrible credit. I've had perfect credit. I've been everywhere in between. So I know how all that stuff personally feels. And I never, you know, I never did appreciate personally people treating you bad because you had, you know, less than stellar credit, because it didn't really, people have bad credit because generally speaking, they did not have multiple streams of income coming in, and they had a primary source of income that got cut off. And I don't care who you are, if you only have one source of income and I cut it off, push is going to come to shove at some point, and you're going to have bad credit. It doesn't matter if you're making $1 million a year or 50,000. Right. At some point, you know, expenses exceed your capital reserves and ability to borrow, and you're going to have bad credit. So what we always try to do with the buyers is educate them to their ability to generate multiple streams of income so they don't ever put themselves in that position. Unfortunately, you know, you're not successful with everybody because people are so, sort of ingrained in this one source of income only, or one source of self-employment income or job income or whatever. I'm just telling you, I was there. I had that one source and it went away. That's not fun.
People often get they get bad credit, not because they're bad people, because of circumstances. Like you said, there were a lot of people that were going along just great. And when the real estate market crashed, if real estate was their business, they were just in a world of hurt. And I knew people that had big cash reserves, but you can only sustain that type of situation for so long, and then you're just doomed. You're just doomed if you can't.
Yeah, I mean, I lived just, it.
Yeah, I mean, you really are, and it doesn't mean that those are bad people and that they're necessarily bad risk in the future. Oftentimes, people that have been in that situation, boy, they're bound and determined, come hell or high water, pardon the phrase, not to go there again. And they turn out to be some of your best people.
I completely agree with you. I mean, and that's the thing, you have to, when we get into pre-qualifying people, people are like, well, the no credit qualifying and all that stuff, that can't be good. But it goes back to what you just said. They don't have a lot of other options. Okay, so we don't deal with, I get maybe one phone call every 18 months that somebody's not paying. And it's very, very rare. And when it happens, again, even though I'm not being compensated for that, I'll jump back in and act as Switzerland and try to bring the two parties together and show the buyer ways they can immediately generate cash so that we can get the seller made whole. And so they try to hold the whole thing together. Because in many cases, they don't know. They don't know what their actual resources are. But it's a very rare thing that, the only time we've ever ended up having to take somebody to court on this thing was back in, I think, 2008 or 2009, maybe 2009, I think. And we've only ended up in court one time for a dispossessory action in all the deals we've done in 7 years. And I'm looking forward to never going back, thankfully. And we did everything we possibly could at that point. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately, you're dealing with the general public, and sometimes people just do stupid things. But the multiple streams thing, it's imperative, in my opinion, for everybody, not just our tenants, but me, you, Bill, all your listeners, because if you're relying on that one source, I mean, you got problems. It's only a matter of time. It's a ticking time bomb waiting to go off. Markets change. Things happen. You know, industries collide, all kinds of things happen. So I just would never want to be personally reliant on one source of income ever again. And so, you know, when you're looking at the pre-qualification standpoint, like you mentioned a minute ago, and I've told this to, you know, people beforehand, they call me up and they're like, oh, well, I had a Chapter 7. And, you know, they're giving me the normal spiel, okay, about all the things that they're upset about and all the reasons they've been told they don't qualify for everybody else's rental or mortgage or any of that stuff. And I have to explain to them, listen, I don't want you to take what I'm saying the wrong way. Okay. But from an investor's perspective, if I put my investor hat on and you're telling me that you just went through Chapter 7 and the bank won't lend you any money. Okay. And they're doing that because you had this track record of not paying your bills and you wrote off all this debt. To me, that's idiotic, and I'll tell you why. I'm going to put my investor hat back on for a second. Well, let's look at this. You just filed Chapter 7. What does that mean? That means that now you don't owe anybody any money. So if you have income coming in, you don't have any issues with paying your bills on time because you don't owe anybody anything. So the house payment goes into a much better scenario. As far as it being paid. The other thing is that you don't have a lot of other options because of the bankruptcy. So you have a lot more motivation to make sure that I get paid on time. And you can't file bankruptcy against me because you can't file again for another 10 years.
Right.
So if I have a buyer that comes in and they don't owe anybody any money, they can't file bankruptcy on me, and they don't have a whole lot of other options, how is that a bad deal?
Great point you make there. Great point. Well, Vince, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this information today. I think it's a fascinating business model you've built, and kudos to you for doing that. And I know that you have a complete training program that folks can learn from you, and I wanted to be sure to include a link back to your website. You want to tell people a little bit about that real quick?
Yeah, we have a, it's a private Facebook group that people can come into, and we've got tons of information that's there for free. People have taken that information and done deals on their own and made a lot of money. People have taken that information and done deals where they've joint ventured deals with me and made a lot of money. And we also do, we also have a coaching program that we go through that kind of walks people through where they get to work one-on-one with me on deals. And I'll give you an example of a deal we just did with one of our coaching clients and JV partners where we closed a transaction like what we're talking about here. We pulled $14,000 for the down payment up front. There's about $1,250 a month in cash flow that we're splitting. And there should be about another $100,000 or so split on the backside when the buyer does the takeout and refinances here, hopefully in the next 12 months. So there's tremendous opportunity that's out there if you know how to put deals together and think outside the box and creatively structure things. And what I would really say is the biggest takeaway from this that people should have is that, you know, you have to be careful listening to all these other voices and noise that's out there, because you don't have to have money. You don't have to have credit. You don't have to waste $4 a gallon on gasoline to see houses, go to showings, go to attorneys to close, wait for checks to clear, all that. You don't have to do any of that stuff, provided you're doing things, you know, legally compliant with Dodd-Frank and, you know, the state, whatever the state laws are that you're operating under. And you can make money. You can make six figures from your house with nothing but a computer and an internet connection. Don't have to spend any money on marketing. You can do it all for free. I had to. I had no other choice. So that's really the big takeaway, because I think that would give a lot of people a lot of hope. And if they would actually put the effort in, demonstrate a little bit of drive and some tenacity and get hungry and go out there and make it happen, it could be a life changer for a lot of people. I mean, it really could be, as opposed to having to do, to spend a lot of money on all these systems and courses. And I showed people how to do it for free. And people are like, why would you do that? Aren't you worried about competition? And the answer is no. Okay. The only people worried about competition are those who can't think critically and can't innovate. I'm not worried about competition. I can't do every deal that's out there. Why do I care if somebody else learns what we're doing? They can go make money. There's plenty of deals. I've only got, you know, eight or 10 hours in a day that I'm, you know, willing to work anyway. So that doesn't leave a whole lot of room for 50 states of deals, you know, that are being done. So we give it all away for free. And that's why I got so much buzz last year.
I think it's great. And for those of you that are listening, I will put all those links so that you can connect up with Vincent. And I think he's very giving and teaching people how to do this business. And so thanks again, Vincent, for coming on. And this is Sharon Bornholt with the Louisville Gals Real Estate Blog. And I'll be back next week with another episode of Let's Talk Real Estate Investing.